Oh, wait, you're listening.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
You're listening to Radiolab.
Radiolab.
From
WNYC.
See?
Yeah.
And NPR.
Who's the gentleman we're on the air with?
Matt.
Oh, there's going to be two of us. So one of them is named Jad. That's not me. His name is Jad, like his parents call him Jad.
Jad?
But it's Jad, really.
Had they been drinking?
No, they're Lebanese.
Oh, sorry.
So we're going to begin the show with this delightful duo.
I'm Julie.
Julie Moss.
I'm Wendy.
Wendy Ingram. Hi, Julie. Hi, Wendy.
Hi, Jad.
They've been friends for a really long time.
Remember that one time you bought all that?
Everything in a tube.
They both like to travel. They both like to shop. And they both like to run really long distances until they collapse, usually in front of millions of people. Now, Wendy.
Wendy was a classic athlete from day one.
Was apparently born this way.
Her mother tells me how she had to channel her energy into sports.
Yeah. I always considered myself a science project.
What do you mean?
We've been created. We have hands, feet. We have a mind. We have lungs. We have a heart. Let's see what it can do.
Wendy, we're very opposite in that respect.
Julie is an entirely different story, and we're going to tell you that story in just a moment. But first, we should say, this is Radiolab. I'm Jad Abumrad.
And I'm Robert Kulwich.
Our topic today is limits. Limits of
the body.
Right.
Start there.
Then the limits of the brain.
And finally, the limits of what we can know about everything.
Julie, how did you get interested in this race that you're about to tell us about? Was it like a...
Like an impulse or something?
Well, no, it was a requirement to graduate.
Oh.
I had to do a, it's called a senior project. I went to Cal Poly San Luis Obispo in California, and I was a PE major, which now I
like phys ed, you mean?
Yeah, and that was just by default. I was a California surfer girl. I started surfing at 14, but I needed a senior project, and there I was in 1981 watching TV instead of studying. And on comes ABC Wild World of Sports.
Brought to you by Anheuser-Busch Natural Light.
The Iron Man from Hawaii. And I watched it and it just sucked me in.
This must have been like really early Iron Man.
I think it was the fourth one. And I thought, it's in Hawaii, it's great. I know my mom will pay for it because I have to do this project for school. And so I started doing research on it.
And this, just so we know, this is you swim, you bike, you run, that's the order?
You swim 2.4 miles, you ride 112 miles, and then you run a marathon.
Wow.
So it was...
But wait a second, though.
Go ahead.
That seems like a major decision to want to go 140... I mean, were you a triathlete-type person at that point in your life? Had you ran a marathon before?
It was conceptual. Those were just the distances. Those were numbers. That wasn't reality. It was just, you were in Hawaii. By the time I got off the plane to do the Ironman, I still hadn't completed the total distance that I'd need to do on the bike or the swim.
Oh, my God.
Wow.
But I wasn't going over there to be competitive. I was going over there to do this event, have fun in Hawaii, and then I'll write up some sort of bogus, you know, physiological consequences or something. But I really just, I thought I was taking the easy way out.
When you got off the bus or you walked into the room where the other ones were, did you suddenly think, uh-oh?
Yeah, I mean, people were taking it very seriously. People had coordinated outfits. And they, I thought, I'm feeling a little like the country mouse, you know. So I think when race day rolled around, it was sort of my day to get through and never do again. I mean, it was really, this is a one-time thing.
So shall we run the race?
Yeah, so, okay, you do the first two legs, the swimming and then the biking.
I'm doing really well. You see me on the bike, I'm riding along. I mean, from the old coverage of ABC, I'm smiling at the camera. I'm certainly not in an aerodynamic position. Why would you want to be all crouched over when you could be sitting up smiling?
That was your beauty queen turn. You're going, hello!
I was doing parade waves. I really was. Loving the attention. And I had a Snickers bar early on the bike ride, and I keep thinking, if I'd only eaten that Snickers bar instead of throwing it away, ABC came up on a camera, and there I was trying to open this melted Snickers bar with my teeth, and all of a sudden there's a camera, and it's like, oh my gosh, I don't want to be messy on national TV, so I ditched this beautiful Snickers bar, and, you know, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, skipping to the third leg of the race. Julie's through the swim. She's through the 112-mile bike ride. Onto the marathon.
I came off the bike. They told me there's a woman ahead of you. And she was a top-notch cyclist.
Oh, so you were in second place.
Yeah.
Whoa, how did that happen?
I was doing really well, and I started on the run, and the one gal who had had a great bike ride had an Achilles injury, and sure enough, I think about 8 miles or so, I caught her, and there I am in the lead.
Wow.
And all of a sudden, it was a little, things started to shift. I'm good at something.
Yeah.
And somebody's trying to take it away from me. And that was the woman who was in second place, Kathleen McCartney. And even though she was a mile away, it felt like she was breathing down my neck and trying to take something that now I was becoming very attached to. I was also starting to fall apart physically.
What were those early signs?
Cramping and a feeling that you weren't digesting your food, that everything was sort of sitting there sloshing around. Wendy's laughing. This is a serious moment, and she's laughing about this.
In any case, finally Julie makes it to the last little itty-bitty stretch of the race.
Probably about 400 meters from the finish.
And she's still in first place. So Julie, let's do this. I'm actually, as we're talking, I'm watching you on YouTube.
Oh, stinker.
Well, I just want you to take me into your head in these final moments, because it's just, like, it's unwatchable, but you can't turn away.
Yeah, it's a train wreck.
So I'm looking at you now, and you're running, and it's dark.
Mm-hmm.
There's people, like, on both sides cheering you.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're running, then you're slowing down, then you're really slowing down.
Mm-hmm.
And you're walking a little bit like you're on stilts. And then, like right here, your legs give out.
They give out. And I couldn't get back up. I mean, I thought, get up, and my legs wouldn't work. So I sort of laid there on the ground, and figured out if I put my arms in front of me and leaned on my arms, they would sort of form like a tripod, and I could sort of lean on my arms and kind of got one leg up and one leg up and kind of staggered to a walk and started walking again.
All right, now you're walking again, but you're like...
drunk monkey.
Yeah, really wobbly.
Yeah.
Now all this time, you're conscious that number two is getting closer and closer? Are you conscious of her at all?
Oh yeah, oh yeah. And I had to keep finding a way to keep going. And my thought was, this is mine.
Oh, you just fell again.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
See, this is the one that gets me right here. You fall down and your arms go back. It's like you're dying.
Yeah. And as I was putting one hand in front of the other, I saw this pair of tennies go by, and these legs, and I thought, that's her. She's gone by me. And it was just, I just thought, I quit. I just thought, I can't say it on National Public Radio, but F it.
Yeah.
F it. And all of a sudden, there's this voice that just said, get up. Get up. Just keep moving forward. And I could see the finish line about 10 feet in front of me, and I thought, get up. I can't get up again. I get up. Do not think I've sort of worn out that tactic. Get up. But I can crawl.
Nobody will help me with this. Oh my God.
And I crawl. And so here I am coming along, and the TV camera lights are blinding me, and
no one's helping her.
My life was going to be different. I mean, I felt my life changing. I made a deal with myself. A deal was struck. And I don't care if it hurts. I don't care if it's messy. I don't care how it looks. I would finish. I would finish. I would finish.
So Julie Moss crawls the last 10 feet of the race, literally an inch at a time. That whole time, the cameras are on her, and they capture everything. And I mean everything.
Yeah. I pooped my pants on national TV. It doesn't get more shameful from that. Wendy teases me all the time. You know, you were a chocolate mess from, you know, one way or the other.
You can get up here and do this next thing.
Yeah, but it was a pivotal moment in my life.
And to this day, Julie says, the person she is now, it all began with...
that voice that I hadn't ever called upon. That just said, keep moving forward.
But that's the thing that gets to me. It's like, it didn't say to you, you can't. It actually said exactly the opposite.
Isn't that cool?
I would have thought it would have said, stop. Come on, stop. Lie down.
That's what you look
lie
like.
Down.
Lie down. Lie
now,
down.
Enough. That's your ego. That's your ego that will come in and sabotage. Your real self, there is no limit. You know, I really believe that.
You do?
And I absolutely do.
No limit.
Nope. Nope. Nope.
Yeah.
No.
Let's take seriously what Julie Moss just said, that there are no limits. I think she meant psychologically,
there are obviously limits if she...
Yes. But
she could die.
You could die.
Yeah.
But short of that, you would say it is her muscles that are determining the limits, right?
Exactly. And the cell, your muscle cell.
Yeah, let's just question that for a second. Let me introduce you to a guy. His name is, what's his name?
David Jones.
His name is David Jones.
Hi.
That's him. He's a retired physiologist.
At Metropolitan University.
And he's got a slight condition that interferes with his speech, just so you know.
Okay.
Anyways, he did a study, two studies actually, that involved bikers.
These are experienced cyclists.
He'll have these people ride stationary bikes for really long distances.
Yep.
All the while, he'll shoot their muscles full of sugar, like with an IV.
And you can actually get extremely high levels of glucose in the blood.
How much? Like a whole energy drink's worth of sugar straight into their blood?
Oh, more than that. Probably several energy drinks.
Oh. Now, theoretically, if it's your muscles that are controlling how far and fast you bike, you should get this injection and just be like, phew.
They should be performing miracles, that's right.
But it never works.
It never works.
Yeah, the people who have sugar in their muscles do the same as the people who don't.
That's right.
I mean, it doesn't work at all?
It made absolutely no difference in their performance.
Whoa, bad news for sugar.
And what it suggests is that our muscles have way less to do with our limits than we think, which raises the obvious question, what is making the difference?
Mm.
So now I'm going to tell you about this second study, which I completely find mind-blowing. Although it's a hard study to summarize, but I'm going to try.
Okay.
So are you with me?
I'm with you so far. You haven't started yet, though. That's always a good place to be.
I need your full participation and interest.
Okay.
Okay, so he does a study where he puts a bunch of bikers on bikes and he has them pedal a lot.
It's about 40 kilometers.
Long distance.
Yeah.
Now, he's got two groups. Each group gets an energy drink, which they sort of have to drink.
While biking,
except that they don't drink it. The rule is they don't actually drink it. They just swish it in their mouth.
And spit it out.
Swish and spit.
That's right. That's what they do. Swish, spit, bike. Swish, spit, bike.
Well, wouldn't want to be the towel guy in this particular experiment.
Well, apparently they have scientists with buckets who just stand next to them.
And they spit into the bucket.
Okay.
So half the people get real energy drink to swish and spit.
Yep.
Half the people get fake energy drink to swish and spit.
And they both taste the same.
And nobody knows who's getting what.
It's a double blind experiment.
So you would think in this scenario that nobody should get any benefit from this because no one's actually drinking the drink. Nothing's getting into the body.
Mm-hmm.
Or let's say the taste creates a placebo effect. Well, then everybody should get the placebo effect equally.
Everybody should get it.
But here's the thing. Only the people who swished, not drank, but swished the real energy drink got a boost.
Oh.
How much of a boost?
It's a minute or a couple of minutes.
Whoa, that's a lot.
Yeah, a minute. That's the difference between finishing first and last.
Yeah.
So let me think here, but don't say anything for a minute. Let me just think about this. So maybe something in the first set of athletes who got the real drink, something inside them knew something.
Yeah! Here's the big theory. You want the little theory or the big one first?
Well, I'd like the big theory briefly.
Okay, the big one, briefly. There's an idea that's been floating around for a while called the central governor theory, which is that inside your head there's this little circuit, which you're starting to see on brain scans, but there's this little circuit that governs your energy supply. and when it feels like you're in danger of running low, it'll trigger signals of pain to be sent to your body to try and get you to rest. Now, what scientists are finding is that this governor circuit is really conservative. It'll send you pain to try and get you to stop way before you are out of juice.
So if you were a fuel tank, they would flash E for empty, but
you got a quarter tank left. So what might be happening with these bikers is that the sugar is landing on their tongue. The tongue sees the sugar, sends a message to the brain. The governor sees this message and says, oh, if we're about to get some energy, then it's okay for you to spend some energy. And let me just give you some from my secret stash over here. And so you feel a boost.
So the conjecture here is you have a reservoir of extra stuff, but it is so deeply disguised that you can't even know that it's there.
Exactly. And to skip to the punchline, when you feel tired, Mr. K, not just tired, when you are dead.
Spent.
When you are spent.
Yeah.
Which does not feel like a subjective thing at all. That feels like an objective reality. You are done. Well, in fact, at that moment, maybe you're not. Maybe you're just feeling the effects of that little governor lying to you.
Oh.
Which raises the question, what if you could lie back to her? Then, how far could you go? So, with all that in mind, we're going to kick it up a notch. Let me tell you about this competition called The Ride Across America. It should really be called The Ride Into the Hellfire Depths of Despair, but we're going to call it The Ride Across
America.
Didn't
have quite the zing that the sponsor wanted. Ride Into the Depths of Despair with Wrigley, Spearwood Gum.
We heard about this first from a reporter named Daniel Coyle. So what is The Ride Across America?
It is basically, it's an insane event. You get on a bike in California and you bike across the country, 3,000 miles, the equivalent of 4 Mount Everests, and they don't sleep.
At all?
No, they will sleep. They'll sleep an hour a day, 2 hours a day.
An hour a day?
Yeah.
So if this is a 10-day race, they will sleep for 10 hours over the length of the race?
Yeah. It's a race that is designed to reveal what human limits are.
Who does it? Can you describe the kinds of people who are attracted to this?
No, I think they come from all walks of life. They come from all over the globe. It's a really interesting cross-section.
We actually got curious about this, so we sent our producer Lulu Miller to track down a few of these guys.
Two guys.
Who'd you find?
Well, the first one.
Yes.
His name is Patrick.
Patrick Autissier. I'm 47 years old from France.
He's the rookie. Had you done any kind of long distance cycling before?
No, not at all.
He's actually a scientist.
Biologist, yeah.
Got a wife, 2 kids.
Okay.
And then we've got the champion.
Okay, hello, Yuri's here.
So this is Yuri Robic.
Hello.
He's won this thing 4 times.
On the bike, he's a killer.
My body, I can go also in the rain or cold or the heat.
His job is he's a soldier.
Employed by a Slovenian army. What else? What would you like to know?
Okay, 2005.
So it's the start was at 7 a.m. in San Diego. Start at 9.
You're going to win this year?
Is it like 20 people or 100 people?
25, I think.
So the tape you're hearing right now is actual footage from that day.
Let's go, Patrick!
It turned out the year he did it, there was actually a film crew there following every single ride.
And so I was, really scared. Scared at him.
Not Yuri, though.
No.
He's just in front of Patrick.
I'm really, how to say in English, I'm really sure in myself.
4, 3, 2, 1.
Then the race is on.
It's easy. You just start your engine and go.
But for me, since I didn't know what to expect, I was running very conservatively. At the back of the pack.
14 states, 3,000 miles to go.
They don't go very fast. They'll cross the country going about 13, 14 miles an hour, which any 11-year-old could ride for a time. The difference is that they just don't stop.
7 hours later, California desert.
It's really hot.
My watch says 109 degrees. We're in the shade in the car.
This is Steve Touty, the camera guy following Patrick in a van.
Patrick's out here climbing a hill.
I've never experienced this kind of temperature. I mean, 110 Fahrenheit.
Then, 150 miles later.
Arizona, rolling hills, sunset.
200 miles, 300 miles.
Then, the sun is rising.
400 miles, 500 miles.
Utah, it's still very hot.
And then?
Colorado. The mountains, the big mountains.
Yuri's in the lead. He's just crested the top of a 12-mile climb.
It was during the middle of the night. It was raining, really heavy rain.
He begins to coast downward.
Descending without pedaling. And after 2 kilometers, I was completely frozen. Shaking like I was electric.
Your butt is like a hamburger.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all red. You don't have any skin at all.
I mean, the bike is the most efficient machine for creating suffering ever invented. The pressure's on your hands. The pressure is on your neck.
This is this British guy named Chris Hopkinson, halfway through the race, and his neck has just given out.
People whose necks have given out will take duct tape and literally tie their heads up. They'll put a cord to the back of their helmet and then pin it, say, to their belt.
Jesus God.
So that they can look, because they can no longer hold their heads up.
Oh, God.
The pain is like waves, you know? And I don't know why it's that, but it is. It's like waves. It's coming and it's going. It's coming and it's going.
So Lulu, is assuming that the central governor circuits inside the heads of all these riders are creating those waves of pain.
Yeah.
How do they soldier on? How do they ignore it?
Well, I asked them that, and they each sort of have different techniques. So Patrick, he'll just start shouting back at it.
Literally.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And Yuri, well, he gets his crew to come up alongside him and blare Slovenian war songs.
Through the speakers, yeah, very loudly.
Is that what we're hearing?
It is. This is him on his bike during the race, singing along. And all of this works for a while. But then, they hit the halfway point.
Kansas. I don't know if you've been to Kansas, live there. It's awful.
The scenery gets really monotonous.
Then you don't have any sightseeing, nothing.
And more than that, they've gone over 1,000 miles without sleeping, basically.
And that's where we see the sort of really interesting stuff start to happen.
It's here that we can catch a glimpse of the hidden potential of the human body.
If you've done everything, if you've handled the heat and the hydration, if your infrastructure is solid, all the stress goes to the last point, which is the mind.
It came very suddenly. It was dark. We were in a forest. And very quickly, the environment got very aggressive.
He said he saw shadows running across the road. It looked like the trees were trying to reach out to get him.
I was starting to have nightmares, but I was awake.
These kinds of hallucinations are just a fact of the race.
People seeing secret code in the cracks of the road. Riders jumping off their bikes to square off and fight mailboxes.
And it's what breaks a lot of people.
Yeah.
But strangely, these kinds of hallucinations might be the very key to Yuri's success.
I saw everything. I mean, a lot of like monsters. Like zombies. He's gonna attack you, you know.
And why would that help him?
Well, to me, it was really, think really, about yeah. Why the central governor is in place.
The system that's designed to always keep an emergency stash of energy there for you, should you ever need it.
So those feelings of pain are really just a way of safeguarding that last
little stash of energy that you could use if you absolutely had to.
Yeah, like if your life was on the line or something.
That's right.
But what if you were convinced, and therefore your central governor was convinced, that your life really was on the line? That year when Yuri got to Ohio,
He hallucinated that there were Mujahideen, sort of Afghan horsemen, chasing him.
Yeah. with a gun, with a shotgun, and I said to my crew chief, hey, they are shooting us. Come on, come on, do something. We are soldiers. Do something to this guy. They are attacking us.
The interesting thing about that is the way in which his team sees him hallucinating, Mujahideen, and their reaction is, oh yeah, we see him too.
Come on, Yuri, you might escape.
Wait, why?
Because they're
gaining on us.
They're gaining on us.
It's funny, you know, but for me it was not funny.
They will use his hallucination as fuel, and they make no bones about it.
And when you see that...
That's Matyaz Planinchek, Yuri's crew chief.
When you see him riding that fast after 5-6 days almost dying on the bike, and then suddenly he explodes, your hair on your arm will go up, on your neck will go up, and then you know that's why you are there, because you don't want to miss that moment, because this is something out of this world.
Yuri says that during the hallucinations...
I mean, the pain is gone.
Does it go away completely?
Yeah.
But the trade-off is that when he watches videos of himself like this, punching mailboxes and throwing his bike into a ditch, he says it's actually painful to watch.
You know, it's really tough for me to look at myself in these videos, in these films, how my behavior is going.
The reality is, he's looking at a madman.
It's not me. That's not me.
Yeah.
See, now I'm thinking, like, Daniel, like, if madness is the key, right, to tricking your central governor into giving you access to that energy, does that mean that if Robert and I went mad in that particular way, that we would suddenly be really athletic? I mean, are there actually seriously cases like that?
Well, there was actually in the early 1900s, there was a doctor named Auguste Bierre who noticed a mental patient making a leap in an asylum, and he measured the leap, and it compared rather favorably to the world record at the time.
What?
Yeah. And he was one of the early sort of propagators of this governor theory that obviously this patient from whom all the sort of governors had been lifted was capable of a feat of astounding strength.
All right, so Lulu, what happened at the end of the race?
Well,
from Slovenia,
Yuri wins.
Yuri Robek.
I won the ram. That's something.
And what about Patrick?
Well, let's rewind a couple days. He's just crossed the halfway point in Mount Vernon, Kansas, and he decides to hop off his bike, take a quick break, and he's in the van. He checks his email.
Just to give me some motivation.
And he sees an email from one of his friends.
He said, "We're so sad that the Dr. Breedlove accident."
Patrick had no idea what this guy was talking about, but it appeared to suggest that one of the 25 riders, a guy named Dr. Bob Breedlove, had just been hurt.
And so I asked one of my crew members what happened with Dr. Breedlove. And he said, well, he got an accident and he died.
On the race? During the race?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so when he told me this, I mean, immediately I was not only shocked, but I was done.
I understand, Patrick. I feel bad too. Obviously, I feel bad.
And so, Steve, today the cameraman tried to push me.
But it would be pointless to stop here, where you have a wide shoulder, a van right behind you.
Who's going to call Anne Cécile and tell her, Patrick just fell down the road, and so he's hospitalized, or even worse. I have kids and a wife. I went too far on this race.
I understand, Patrick, but how far to the next time station? Why don't we go there?
No, dead. I don't want to continue that. That's okay. I don't want to continue that.
I'm just saying, let's not throw in the towel just yet.
So after that, I mean, I started riding again. But for them,
yeah.
It was a magical night. It was very, very warm, a beautiful night. No clouds, nothing.
And as always, his crew is cheering him on, trying to pump him up.
You're strong!
Patrick, can I ask you why you're doing this?
What?
Can I ask you a question? You're doing, you want to talk.
Uh-huh.
Why are you doing this?
But he's not saying anything back for hours. Then, around 1 a.m, Patrick says his mind just goes quiet.
Completely silent.
Out of that silence, he said he heard a voice that said simply,
"You stop. Stop." And so that's what I did. I said, "I'm done."
"You done?
Why?
I'm done with the race. I'm done. You asked me a question earlier, remember? Why I was doing that?"
"Yeah, why are you doing it?"
"Because I just wanted to test my limit, physical limit and mental. And I touched twice this limit, yesterday morning and this morning. And I don't want to leave that again."
And I quit. That's it.
Huh. I'm trying to figure out who I would honor more.
Yeah.
The winner of the race or the man who insisted on losing.
I'm 40. I've got kids. I identified more with the guy who stopped.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think also you see the guy who wins and it makes you ask big questions about what's possible. You know?
Yeah. Like, how do you do that?
Yeah. I don't know that I'd want to be that guy or even hang out with him. Probably like the second guy.
I know I'd like the second guy. Oh, mm. Dan, what do you think?
I find myself looking at both of them kind of with my jaw on the floor.
Daniel Coyle's latest book is called The Talent Code. And thanks, Lulu.
Yeah, and a huge thanks to Stephen Auerbach, who made the film Bicycle Dreams. That's where all this footage came from.
"Hey, Michael, this is Wendy Ingram, and I apologize, I have a pretty bad cold. Radiolab is funded in part by Alfred P. Sloan Foundation and the National Science Foundation."
"This is Julie Moss. Radiolab is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR.